What is it that makes the British seaside sinister? Why does it seem to attract so many killers? Is it the fact that the tide washes away their sins? Is it the fact that it's the end of the line? There's nothing overly frightening about a big wheel or a carousel. But what is undeniable is that the British seaside attracts and has always attracted death and murder. Hello, I'm Geoffrey Wonsall. I write about crime, true crime. And in this new series, I want you to join me on a journey to the cliff's edge, where land meets the sea and where life meets death. For make no mistake, there is something sinister about our British seaside towns. On the surface, they're all funfairs, candy floss and breezy promenades. But by digging a little deeper in the sand, we uncover an underworld of misfits and misfeasance, murder and mayhem. And reveal the dark lives of the most deadly coastal killers to ever stalk our shores. Sunderland is probably not synonymous in many people's minds with the seaside. It's more famous perhaps for manufacturing or its football team. But in fact, it was home to a notorious serial killer, Stephen Greaveson, who, believe it or not, went to work as a fairground worker. Stephen Greaveson had been born and brought up in Sunderland in a troubled family. But by the age of 20, he had killed for the first time. He was to go on to kill relentlessly and earn himself the nickname of the Sunderland Strangler. He was, in almost every respect, an utterly ruthless and unprincipled killer.
Brady, Hindley, Rose West and Fred West, we know those names. They're in our DNA, our criminal DNA. But Greaveson, who's heard of Greaveson? Not very many people at all. Yet he's one of the most disgusting and vile serial killers this country's known.
My feeling would be this is the kind of behaviour I would expect from a psychopath. This total lack of any moral values, no concern about what he's done, no taking responsibility. This sense of lack of emotion, lack of guilt, lack of responsibility. Those are the signs I would expect to see in a psychopath.
It's curious as to why Greaveson's case wasn't more in the public eye, why isn't more known about it. Perhaps this is one of those cases where something was tucked away near the coast, out of sight and out of mind.
Stephen Greaveson was in many ways an archetypal serial killer. He had a monstrous childhood, one of seven children. When his father left, his mother admitted that she couldn't really cope with them and she preferred going to the bingo. By the time he's 18, He's a glue-sniffing rent boy who is used to being abused by older men for money and who has no concept of morality whatever. Grieveson was an explosion waiting to happen.
Stephen Grieveson did not have one of the best of starts in life. His parents split up, they were abusive to each other whilst they were together, and he was kind of like the product of this. He went seriously off the rails at the age of 11 and began kind of very petty theft, etc. This kind of progressed because he was sent to a children's home. He was being brought up by a single parent. She wasn't, by her own admission, the best of mothers at that time. And he kind of like brought his career life into focus through the kind of lens, if you like, of a children's home.
It suggested that he had been physically and sexually abused in care.
This may have completely changed a normal child into someone who was more feral. He may have been subjected to abuse. He may have subjected others to abuse. This was kind of like a learning cycle, and he would not have picked up good career motives here. He would be picking up more criminal intent. It could also be that, as a chicken and egg situation, that he was kind of like attracted to this, that he was actually thrived in this environment. He could have had pre-existing psychopathic traits that developed when he became an adolescent, and this was part and parcel of the kind of life that he would have enjoyed. It's difficult to say which way, but we do know the outcome.
Very often when you get people like Stephen Grieveson, a serial killer, they go through quite a few different homes, and there is evidence when you start looking through their background and antecedents, you find evidence of abuse within the system, if you like. And he certainly claimed quite a lot of abuse as a child and growing up into his teens. Of abuse and witnessing it, and he was also practicing it himself. You know, it wasn't just a point that he was a victim, he'd actually turned into an abuser himself, and there was issues around his own behavior that had to be addressed as well, which weren't.
He did have a disturbed childhood, and from his background was very poor in many ways. He didn't have the warm, nurturing, cultured family that his victims had. His victims were by far very much sexually innocent boys on the edge of sexuality, and he clearly had actually targeted them for his own sexual gratification.
Something that made Grieveson unusual amongst serial murderers was that he targeted teenage boys who had all been pupils at the same school, a school which he had never attended.
At the time, I was head teacher of a school called Monquimouth School in a leafy suburb of Sunderland. It was a school that had a good reputation. It was a school where the children seemed to enjoy coming. It was a school that I thoroughly enjoyed working at. I moved on to another school later, but I still have a lot of affection for Monquimouth School.
Stephen Grieveson was a homeless individual. Once he started life on the street, he would fixate. He would actually live and monitor children from the same school walking up and down on the way to school and on the way home. He started recognising them. He started looking at the uniforms. He started almost obsessionally becoming part and parcel of their lives and wanting to engage with them, wanting to be their friend and wanting, obviously, to carry out his sexual deviant acts on them.
By the age of 19, Grieveson was out of control. But he was also a repressed homosexual. He wasn't happy to admit it. And in May 1990, he encounters a 14-year-old boy called Simon Martin.
started playing football with a 14-year-old, Simon Martin. He then seems to have inveigled him into a sort of secluded spot, and he says that a sex act took place between them. He then ended up, I think, strangling and then sort of beating the poor boy with a piece of rubble.
Grieveson committed his first murder as a progression from his sexual acts with a young boy. This was something he needed to cover up, and he threatened the boy. He put his hands around the neck, and he slowly but surely progressed into strangling the boy. He then cemented this by picking up a large rock and smashing the guy's head in.
He then transported him to a safer area and then set fire to his body. This is a man who knows enough about crime to not leave evidence and determined enough not to be caught. We don't know too much about his early sexuality, but we can assume that he is brought up in a heterosexual, macho-male atmosphere. That's the role he's designated to play. For him, unfortunately, he was bisexual, and he was giving in to his homosexual tendencies, but feeling guilty afterwards. Rather than coming out and saying, OK, he's gay, and full stop, he was trying to hide his sexuality and hide what he was doing. But I would see that very much within the 1990s culture of men being men, and still the early days before men were allowed to be gay.
It was clearly something he wanted to prevent his mother knowing about, even though she was quite aware of it. He wanted to kind of hide this at all costs, and that cost actually ran to being someone who killed to keep people quiet. He would start by threatening an individual that if they revealed his sexual nature, that, you know, he would come and get them. But this progressed into actually killing them eventually with a ligature. And this was something that he'd repeated again and again.
In May 1990, head teacher Jim Farney was informed by the authorities that one of his pupils was missing. It would prove to be the first of many such worrying visits that would lead to news of a tragic outcome for the boys in question.
I first learned about Simon Martin and the fact that he was missing. And that's all it was at that time. A young lad had gone missing. Simon was just a very ordinary lad, nobody that would be concerned about at school. And to begin with, it was just, oh, he's probably gone to a friend's or he's gone somewhere. But eventually, when I was informed that he'd been found face down in a derelict house, he'd been hit on the back of the head and just left in this derelict house to die. As a head teacher, you do lose pupils. Pupils had killed in accidents and so on, but when you're informed that he's been murdered, the cloud that comes over the school community is very, very different.
Thus, Grieveson was looking forward, if you like, to a life whereby each kind of sexual act with a stranger would be something that ended in murder. He was going to be a serial killer. By definition, it would be inevitable because it wouldn't be just a one-off killing this.
Grieveson's first victim was 14-year-old Simon Martin. He abused him, he had sex with him, and he strangled him. without a moment's compunction. That was clearly to conceal his own guilt at his homosexuality. Grieveson was a murder machine waiting to happen. He was not to kill again for a number of years. He lay dormant, but when he awoke, he became a fully fledged serial killer. Stephen Grieveson, by now, had already killed. But there was no stopping him. He had been abused as a child and felt angry with himself because of his own confusion about his sexuality. He wanted to conceal the fact that he was gay and yet couldn't conceal it from himself. He commits another murder, another boy in an abandoned house in Roker Terrace. Ironically and incredibly, a house which had been a children's home, in which almost certainly boys had been abused as he'd been abused as a boy.
Grieveson's second victim was another much-loved young teenager, Thomas Kelly. Police would eventually find his body dumped in a glass house.
Yeah, when I was informed about Thomas, it was exactly deja vu. But the thing that I remember mainly about this was that Thomas was a lad that had gone through school. He was not terrifically academically bright, but he'd gone through school. Was friendly with a lot of people. He was the sort of lad that got on with most people and staff. His body had been burned. There was evidence that he'd been found with a plastic bag over his head.
He'd manipulated the crime scene. He made it look like there was solvent abuse, and solvent abuse that had gone wrong, so you may well have had somebody sniffing glue, for example, setting fire to the can and the can exploding. So there was this kind of crime scene that wasn't really viewed by the police at the time as a crime because it was seen as accidental death by substance abuse.
Grieveson's victims were all young males, usually ones that had been to the same school, in fact. His target group basically meant that he was looking for people who were not just sort of that age group, but he was looking for people who would be easily taken away from social view and into places of seclusion quite easily and voluntarily.
Yeah, it's very calculated, very deliberate. He knows, having committed one murder as a result of not wanting to be detected, he then knows that he goes out to commit another murder and he knows he's going to do a murder. I suspect there may have been other sexual behaviour in between, but he goes out to have sex and then he knows he's going to have to kill afterwards. And he does that in a very, very organised manner of actually disposing the body by burning them. It was quite clever because the police didn't pick it up as a sexual murder. The murder was originally thought to have been teenagers playing with drugs, inhalants and things like that, and one of them unfortunately set on fire to himself. If he was sniffing petrol, sniffing glue, then he could have caused the fire.
The police asked me if I knew what a Glasgow hood was, and I hadn't a clue what they meant by a Glasgow hood, and asked if I could find out from some of the pupils. So I spoke to several pupils who I thought might have some idea what was meant by that. There wasn't one single pupil said that they knew what I was talking about. They'd never heard of it. All it was described to me was that they put a plastic bag over their head and somehow put butane gas up inside. I did find it strange that two pupils from the same school would be murdered, although it was 3 years apart. But you don't want to believe that it's the same the same method of murder, if you like, and it was slightly different. So I suppose we were just thinking, well, you know, it's unfortunate that two pupils from the same school have been murdered in what seemed to be two different ways.
Even though they had two dead teenagers on their hands, the police did not believe that they were the victims of any crime, leaving Grieveson to go undetected and allowing him to kill again.
I mean, the thing that links all of them, that they were ordinary boys, boys that sometimes were very funny. They were boys that had a good sense of humour. No indication that they were... Nothing in school, certainly, that led us to believe that they could be taking any sort of drugs, whether it was a Glasgow hoodie or anything else. But the thing that the police seemed to latch on was that the house in which David Hansen was found, his body was found, that there were some butane gas cylinders lying on the ground in the same room. And that confirmed in their minds that it was some sort of drug-related, because he was found with some sort of plastic bag again over his head.
Grieveson's third victim was David Hansen. Once again, he lured the innocent teenager to a lonely place.
I mean, a big problem that the police always have with serial killer crimes is simply realising that there's a serial killer at work. And in the case of Stephen Grieveson, once again, they just didn't spot the pattern. They just could not see that there was somebody committing this series of crimes. And so it took them a long time to sort of join the dots and eventually see the pattern and realise that they had somebody, a fairly sort of calculating figure, who was behind this series of horrific murders.
Grieveson's sexual adventures continued. So did the deaths, and each one following the same pattern, where he isolated the person, took them to a sort of quiet place and committed the sexual act, and then was strangling them with his hands and with a ligature for finality. He then would try and set fire to whatever evidence was left, the body, or even an entire building.
I remember particularly at the funeral of David Hansen, when I was walking out and two detectives pulled me to one side and said, "You need to know we found another one last night." I mean, that was just so shocking. And that's when I thought, is this going to go on? Is this going to go on? This can't be accidents anymore. This is not an accident that this is happening to all of these boys. And it was, I think, the most horrific period of time after that, when every time I got a call from the police, you're wondering, is this happening again?
I think one of the problems that the police felt was that the use of solvents abuse, you know, was quite common. And sometimes, no criticism intended by any stretch of the imagination, but sometimes we can have a thought about an investigation that becomes the thought. And the thought was that these were all young boys experimenting with solvents abuse. Well, maybe one or maybe two, but three young boys start to think, well, hold on a minute, there must be something kind of more to this. This is more than a coincidence.
The national press in particular had headlines, murdered boys from drug school. And first of all, for the parents to read that about their old children must have been soul-destroying. But again, from a professional point of view, as a head teacher of a school that is labelled and having the cameras from TV companies outside with cherry pickers filming with close-up inside the classrooms was so difficult for us to manage. We had several police officers in school, detectives, had to allocate rooms for them. Parents had to either sit with the child or have a member of staff or myself in loco parentis to sit with the child. And questions all the time about who else is on drugs and how many pupils have you got on drugs. And thankfully it was the judge in Leeds in the Crown Court who actually held the newspaper up and said, this is a very good school, the Ofsted reports are excellent, and people have got to stop labelling it so. But they never ever said that for the families, let's not label the boys. It was about the school.
What made Grieveson's crimes so horrific was that he often set fire to his victims. Not an unusual characteristic in serial killers. Quite often you find, in an effort to conceal what they've done, they set fire to the body. But Grieveson was also trying to conceal his own conflict over his homosexuality. Those two concealments made Grieveson very uncomfortable, and yet, if you met him in the street, if you'd seen him in the supermarket, you would have thought him extraordinarily unremarkable. He was by no means a man with horns, a tail, and a black cloak. There is no doubt that by the time the third body was discovered, that the police realised that they had a serial killer on their hands. The difficulty they had was they had no obvious suspect. Grieveson was nothing if not inconspicuous. Early in February 1994, he killed David Hansen, who was 15, but it did not quell the glue-sniffing, drug-using, sexually abused Grieveson. He was to kill again before the end of February. The next victim was another boy from Monk Wearmouth School.
By now, Grieveson had developed a signature as a serial killer, and his final victim, David Grief, was murdered in the same heinous fashion as his previous killings.
This time, he again strangled and burnt the body. That is three murders within a space of a very short time.
It would appear that his sexual drive was the motivating factor. He wanted to have sex, but wasn't willing to accept his homosexual tendencies, so would then have to protect himself. What I find interesting is the gap and whether he was actually engaging in sex with a male somewhere else. Maybe he was working away from home, maybe he had opportunities to have sex safely, but when he engaged with the young boys, he was very risky behaviour, because he knew there was a risk if they weren't homosexual themselves, of them complaining to the police or parents or school. So there was a risk there.
Initially, the police felt that the three deaths were not connected, or in fact were only connected through solvent abuse. And it was only 7 months later when a new senior investigating officer was brought in to the investigation that he asked two eminent pathologists to re-examine the burnt bodies of the victims.
David was found in the same allotment as Thomas Kelly, just round from the hospital on Newcastle Road. Again, he's the same plastic bag and a burned body.
The pathologist discovered that these young men had all been strangled and burnt after death. And it was at that point that the new senior investigating officer thought, well, hold on a minute, this is nothing to do with solvent abuse, this is something to do with one killer being responsible for these three deaths.
It was perhaps Grieverson's brutality that allowed him to evade capture for so long. The fact that he was so thorough in destroying evidence, he made it very difficult for the police to actually piece together a series of crimes. It was more difficult, if you were, to gather any physical evidence of one single person committing these acts. So Grieverson, if you like, became almost invulnerable.
Having gotten away with three murders, Grieverson must have believed himself to be beyond the reach of the law, and he remained set on targeting innocent teenagers.
No one can say why, but what is not in doubt is that boys from Monk Wearmouth School became the hunting ground for Stephen Grieverson, the man who was to become known as the Sunderland Strangler.
One of the easiest things to say about Stephen Grieverson, if you look at the original photographs going back to the crime, the days when he committed his crime, he actually looked like one of the schoolboys himself. Almost angelic, very innocent, very young, very naive. And you can see why children, school children, would look at him and think, he's probably the same age group as us. So they would actually put their trust in him and have that confidence that he wasn't going to be anything bad or wasn't going to do anything nasty to them. So he was able to win them over not only by his charm, but also by his looks, which he used to his own purposes.
I'm not sure whether he chose a school for any particular reason or whether it was just coincidental that all the victims came from the same school. But I imagine it's the age group that he was interested in rather than school.
He wasn't one of my pupils. I didn't know Stephen Grieverson. He was... he attended another local Sunderland school, but he wasn't his reputation as a bit of a bad lad, I guess, was known around the area, which came out. But, you know, when I was told Stephen Grieverson, I vaguely knew of the Grieverson family, but I didn't know Stephen Grieverson. I couldn't have even told you what he looked like.
Grieverson was now absolutely carefree. He thought he could get away with absolutely anything, and he set out to do so. And yet, when he was first arrested by the police, it had nothing to do with the killings. It was simply a matter of a burglary. A burglary, ironically, in the very house that David Hanson, his victim in February, had been found. But the police never connected the dots. There was no connection in their mind.
Stephen Grieverson came to my attention when we were always asking youngsters if they heard anything, if they didn't want to go to the police, they could come to see me or one of their favourite teachers. And this young lad came to me one day and said, I don't know whether this is of any use, but on Friday night, we were walking along a road called Newcastle Road by the hospital, and the friend I was with said, take your baseball cap off, Stephen Greaveson is at the bus stop. And he said, well, who's Stephen Greaveson? He says, oh, he'll probably pinch your baseball cap. So he says, I stuck it up inside my sweater, and we walked past him, but he was standing beside the bus stop just round the corner from the allotments. So I spoke to one of the detectives and gave him the information like I'd done all along. And the police took the issue from there.
Following the community's sharing of information with the police, Greaveson soon found himself firmly on the police radar. He was questioned and eventually arrested on suspicion of the murders of Thomas Kelly, David Hanson, and David Grief. And eventually, he would confess to killing another innocent young boy, Simon Martin.
When Stephen Greaveson is finally brought to trial in 1996, he pleads not guilty. Presumably because he wants the publicity. There can be no doubt that he is as guilty as sin, but he puts the relatives of those three young men, those innocent teenagers, through the horrors of a trial and the details of the way they died in the most horrifying fashion.
Greaveson had been charged with the murders of Thomas Kelly, David Hanson, and David Grief. But the murder of Simon Martin remained unsolved, even though there were chilling parallels to the deaths of the other boys that Greaveson had killed.
It seems the pathologist missed the strangulation marks on Simon Martin's neck. So, once again, this looks like an occasion where a killer has committed his first crime and then developed a kind of technique for committing further crimes later on, because his three subsequent victims were strangled.
Greaveson's method of killing may have related to sexuality. He may have introduced a ligature even during the sexual act, but his burning of the bodies, his destruction of evidence may have gone beyond simple forensic awareness. He may have had a slight awareness of DNA, but I think he was destroying all evidence of the sexual act. He wanted it completely razed to the ground.
8 years after his conviction, Greaveson finally admitted the killings, but he denied forcefully that he killed Simon Martin.
Still in denial until many, many years later, when Stephen Greaveson wrote to all of the family's relatives admitting his guilt and saying how sorry he was and asked for forgiveness.
Despite claiming to feel remorse for the deaths of some of his victims, he still refused to admit his depraved crimes.
It wasn't until 2013 that Greaveson was finally convicted of the murder of the innocent Simon Martin. Sentencing him, the judge had this to say: "This was an horrendous attack and murder of an innocent young boy lured by you for your sexual pleasure."
And it took 20 years in prison before he finally owned up to killing that boy. Now, is this the classic power and control? He knows he's going to prison for a long time. He was sentenced for 35 years. He knows he's going a long time. Does he keep one of his bodies just to keep him happy and in control? And also, there's a psychopathic element of inflicting pain on the family by not telling them what happened. So, was he doing that? And I suspect he probably was. The interesting question is then, why does, after 20 years, he owns up? Is this part of a planned discharge programme? Or, am I being cynical, and is he actually taken responsibility for what he's done? I don't think he perceived himself as a serial killer. I think the killing was secondary to the sex. I think his motive was clearly to have sex with these young schoolboys and didn't want to be caught having sex, didn't want to be seen to be acting in a homosexual way, because he had to keep maintaining this macho male image. And the killing was simply to avoid them telling other people. I don't see him planning it in the same way as other serial killers do. His target was because of his sexual interest, not because of his killing interest.
You have to put yourself in the position of a young boy. He's out playing and an older boy, a younger man, comes up to him and starts chatting to him. The young children are naturally trusting. And I suspect that many of these children actually knew who Grieveson was and they did trust him. And using guile and cunning again, he lured that child somewhere, somewhere dark, somewhere cold. And then the assault started.
Grieveson is currently behind bars for the four murders. The hope of many is that he will never be released for his crimes, this in itself being some small consolation to the families who lost their loved ones in the most cruel fashion imaginable.
Ever since, if I bump into, whether in a professional capacity or otherwise, people still refer to, was that the drug school? And that still hurts.
The Grieveson case is possibly one of the most tragic. It involved young boys starting their lives and tragically having them ended in quite horrific circumstances. He himself had a really bad beginning to life. Perhaps there was no ray of hope in this particular case. Even his mother had regrets that maybe she could have contributed to this pathway. This is a kind of case where there is no light, only dark.
When you actually profile Stephen Grieveson and you look at the targets that he actually had and his victims, they all went to the same school, they all had a uniform, they were all smart-looking boys, tidy. So they were very smart in appearance. They were everything that he yearned for as a child. He wanted to be part of society. He wanted to be accepted by his peers. He wanted to be seen as somebody who could stand out in the crowd, if you like, but be part of a group, to be collectively wanted, to be not an outsider, not an outcast, not somebody who was homeless and living on the streets and begging. He wanted to be those children. And that school and their uniforms and their demeanour, the way they interacted with one another, laughing, joking, playing, having fun, all the things he'd never really had throughout his childhood, he wanted. And that was why he fixated on that type of target.
I want the boys to be remembered as they were, ordinary pupils. They came to school, were not perfect, but got through school in a way that I believe made them happy. I'm certain that they would have made a good life had they lived.
Stephen Grieveson was a man who felt he had nothing to live for and so chose to make it his duty to end the lives of four young men who had everything to live for. To my mind, that makes him one of the most despicable murderers of recent times. Jeffrey Wonsall next time for more Murders by the Sea.